Then we chose this date rather carefully because we thought that after the 24th of November, the position in Iran might be somewhat clearer. I'm afraid to say, I think it has been, in the words of when I was in Northern Ireland, the hurdle has been moved a bit further down the road at the moment rather than finding a way of getting over it. But we wanted to talk about Iran today because it is a very interesting topic. It's one of those topics that you think has a certain categorisation in terms of dealing with it in relation to its nuclear ambitions. And then suddenly, because of what's happening in the region, the wider region, the onset of ISIS, it has another dimension as well. And so it's not as simple or as easy, never it was easy, as we thought it was 6 or 7 months ago. We thought it was a good time to look at what's happening and to ask the question, which we do, as to whether what is happening now is rapprochement or whether we are moving back towards the outhouse that's been with us for so long. It's an interesting question. I'm going to challenge our speakers to try and deal with that. This is not a debate because I think all our speakers have got their own views on Iran, but they're not necessarily the usual polarized versions that we like to have when we have a debate. So we've got a very, very expert panel. I'm going to ask each of them to talk to us for about 10 minutes about how they see the position in Iran being, and then we'll open it as usual to the floor, and at the end of the meeting at 2 o'clock precisely, I will bring it to a close even if we've still got people trying to speak, because one of the things I always promise those who attend here is that we end up at 2 o'clock so they can get back to their work or whatever else they need to get back to. And we've got three excellent panellists today. The first is, on my left, is Sir Richard Dalton, who's spoken here before. He's an Associate Fellow of the Middle East and North Africa Programme of Chatham House and a consultant there. In 2002, he was appointed ambassador to Iran. He played a role in European efforts to negotiate with Iran, including the 2003-2006 diplomatic initiatives to prevent the development of an Iranian military nuclear capability. In 2008, he was responsible for the Chatham House Middle East Programme report, which was entitled Iran Breaking the Nuclear Deadlock. And he convenes the bi-monthly Chatham House Roundtable on Libya. So we have an expert who I'm very much looking forward to hearing, as I am the others. Then on my far left, we've got Norman Lamont, Lord Lamont of Lerwick, who was at the centre of British politics for many years. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1990 to 1993. Chief Secretary to the Treasury under Margaret Thatcher. He was in the House of Commons with me for a good deal of years. He was also a Minister of the Departments of Energy, Defence and Industry. He's here today not only for his past experiences in that regard, but he's also Chairman of the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce and President of the Economic Research Council. And so, again, I'm looking forward very much to hearing what he has to say. Our third speaker is not, as was advertised, Malcolm Rifkin, who sends his apologies because he has to attend the House of Commons for the bill, the security bill, which was announced last week. And as the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, he not only has to speak, but he feels he should attend the whole debate. So he sends his apologies. But not to worry, we have a tremendous person in his place, another member of the Advisory Committee of Global Strategy Forum, Jack Straw, also a former Foreign Secretary, again with a good deal of experience in dealing with matters Iranian, and again I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say. So I'm going to start by asking Richard Dalton if he would speak to us for about 10 minutes.
Thank you very much for inviting me to address you today. I shall talk about two angles of what is quite a big question. First, the likelihood of a nuclear agreement, and second, UK and European policy after an agreement, from which you'll have detected that I'm on the optimistic side of the discussion, and I think an agreement is probable, but I don't think that rapprochement is going to be the right word to describe what happens thereafter. It'll be heavy pounding to get anywhere with Iran. No one knows whether the political will can be generated in Washington, Tehran, and elsewhere to make the final journey down the path laid down last week. Additional flexibility is required from both sides especially on Iran's enrichment capacity during the life of an agreement and on the nature and timing of the lifting of nuclear-related sanctions. It appears that the Supreme Leader is backing President Rouhani and his negotiators. He is choosing tactical flexibility, which would strengthen Iran, rather than unyielding resistance to the enemy, which would weaken Iran further. The Iranians are already putting together a narrative of victory. I don't think this means that they're going to be a pushover at the next stage, but at least they are starting to put across to their own elites and their own people the kind of scenario which would enable them to say that an agreement, even with concessions, is actually a triumph, and that's a good sign. You, of course, know the dangers posed to a rational outcome of these negotiations by those who may try to undermine them, whether in Israel, the US Congress, or indeed on the far right in Iran. The dangers, however, are at their most severe in Washington. The Supreme Leader can bind other centres of power in Iran once he has made up his mind, but the President of the United States cannot. Iran may not be willing yet to make irreversible changes to the number of its operating enrichment centrifuges, about 9,400, and to their timetable for building up their capacity without, and this is the key point, greater political certainty than it has been offered so far that the sanctions will go finally. Will the Supreme Leader believe, against all his instincts and, he would say, his painful experience of US hostility to Iran, that Congress will lift sanctions? Iran will not settle just for relief through presidential waivers, just temporary suspensions that have to be renewed periodically. And will he believe, will the Supreme Leader believe that sanctions will go sufficiently strongly to change his mind about the enrichment capacity he has set out so far as his minimum requirement, which is the current figure of 9,400 operating centrifuges? And that figure, of course, is still too much for the US and its partners. There are plenty of other square brackets in the text, it appears. One of the more difficult ones is the duration of the agreement. Iran wants it as short and the US and its partners as long as possible. Even if a final and full settlement is not reached by the 1st of March, then there is an alternative, a further interim agreement that preserves the gains for both sides in the Joint Programme of Action of November 2013, which was rolled forward last week, with fresh agreements, additional agreements, to limit or adapt some Iranian nuclear activities and give proportionate additional sanctions relief to Iran. Both sides have said that they consider that a final agreement is possible. I see it as probable now. First, because the P5 plus one and Israel do not have a better means of achieving their basic goals, which are credible assurance of the exclusively peaceful nature of the Iranian program in future, preserving the non-proliferation treaty regime, and managing the risks of further nuclear proliferation on the Middle East. They do not have a better means of achieving those aims. Whether Israel will concede that point remains to be seen. We don't know whether they are arguing hard now just to improve the terms of the agreement or whether they will press their resistance to the bitter end and seek to subvert it in Congress over the head of a strong positive recommendation by United States Commander-in-Chief and President that his agreement would be in the United States security interests. And the second reason for thinking that an agreement is probable is because Iran needs the East, needs the West and the East. They've tended to say we can get by just with the East, but it's not true. So fixing Iran's international relations through a nuclear deal is the best way to boost development and seize the future. They could survive, the Islamic Republic could survive politically and economically without a deal, but it would be surviving in ever poorer shape. If the negotiations fail definitively, even after extra time, Iran would face great uncertainty. Additional sanctions, including deeper cuts in its oil exports at a time of much lower prices. China and Russia and others are unlikely to be Iran's salvation in that respect. Iran's fate would be very low growth, with high inflation, acute budgetary stringency, yet more damage to their social fabric, and a higher risk that discontent might eventually risk stability. Of course, none of us, least of all me, have any way of knowing whether the Supreme Leader sees it that way. Perhaps he believes the rhetoric of resistance under which any fate at the hands of the US and its allies is seen to be better than being thought to surrender Iran's dignity. But I doubt it. We know that Rouhani gave him a powerful account of Iran's economic plight soon after his election last year, and though I have no evidence, I suspect that Khamenei has seen through the idea, beloved of the hardliners, that sanctions make Iran stronger by boosting self-reliance. What about rapprochement? You'll see that I think impasse is not written in the stars. After an agreement, and subject to the agreement not being blown off course by non-implementation by one side or the other, there will be a better atmosphere, more political exchanges, and some cooperation. But joint interests, such as Islamic State and the future of Iraq, are not enough to create a political rapprochement. Nor is trade. In fact, it is the other way around. A tolerable bilateral political atmosphere is essential to avoid political discrimination against individual countries by Iran in the sphere of trade and investment. Sadly, Britain is poorly placed to work with Iran in the coming phase. The Supreme Leader's view of Britain is extremely negative. Whenever Englistan comes up, it's always accompanied in his mouth with poisonous language. The head of the Basij, General Naghdi, said of us on the 1st of October, apropos of the Prime Minister's remarks in New York, "They have an evil and criminal character and their government is illegitimate and unjust." On 26 November, his boss, IRGC Major General Safavi, said that England, the Zionist regime and the US created ISIL to foment a civil war between Sunnis and Shias. British policy in face of this situation, whether in the nuclear talks or the general difficult background to our bilateral relations, is extremely cautious. We have strong interests in GCC states, for example, and perhaps HMG thinks we should go carefully with Iran because we have a lot to lose there. We also have what Jack Straw has said in other contexts are self-inflicted wounds. I'm not clear whether we've yet fully accepted Iran's, even at Supreme Leader level, statements of regret and undertakings to abide by diplomatic norms in connection with the invasion of our embassy in 2011. We have been sanctions outliers, i.e. more extreme, introducing financial sanctions outside a EU framework in 2011 and discouraging even legal trade. The Prime Minister put his foot in it thoroughly in New York, abusing Iran within a few minutes of having a first meeting with President Rouhani, which he had actually requested, thereby undermining Rouhani and the idea of an opening up to the UK once Rouhani got back home. And it looks as though HMG is linking the opening of embassies, both here and in Tehran, to prior policy changes by Iran on an aspect of the UK's immigration woes. I won't go into the detail, I may not have understood them correctly, but the key point is that that is a policy change long sought, including by the embassy when I was ambassador in 2005, but long denied to the UK by Iran. We do, of course, have a voice in the EU, thank goodness, and I hope it will be raised in favour of renewing the structures that were used until 2005, a comprehensive dialogue conducted by the chairman of the European Council, supported by the Troika at senior ministerial level, with separate dialogues on key subjects conducted by the competent EU bodies. And I think the EU should set off immediately to establish a similar but updated framework once a nuclear agreement has entered into force. A good start would be an EU office in Tehran, which there has never been. There are lots of things we can be saying to Iran, of course. We should give our support to the ideas of economic reform, that if they want partnerships with the West, then less corruption, fewer sweetheart deals with favoured Iranian public sector firms, reform in the oil sector would be vital. We should suggest that Iran shouldn't be expecting to be the dominant power in its neighbourhood. Other states have a right to make alliances. We should encourage commitment to détente with its neighbours, which Zarif has already declared is the aim of his ministry. Seeking to resolve disputes, extend common ground, that's in our interests as well as Iranian ones. We could call for less suspicion of foreigners, less searching for and believing in conspiracies, hostile foreign hands, less zero-sum thinking in its relations with the West. And out of that emerges the idea that Iran should extend its dealings with the United States, including on counter-terrorism. The EU approach from 1997 to 2005 was, I think, right, but we failed to make progress, largely through lack of leverage, and partly because Iran was both not ready and not willing to go as far as we wanted. Then it was trade, Afghanistan, and drugs that went best in those discussions. We got nowhere on counter-terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, Middle East peace process, Iraq, and human rights. And that was under the relatively good days of a Khatami government. This time, in 2015, if all goes well, the EU will be engaging Iran on trade and investment, energy, long-term security issues in the Persian Gulf, Iraq, Syria, Middle East peace process, and human rights. The approach that has a chance of success, of course, is one that plays down the lecturing and one that's based on seeking mutual advantage. So to sum up, the better state of relations between us and Iran will be slow in coming, uneven across the different issues in play, and subject to politically inspired reverses from both sides as events play out. Rapprochement, perhaps, but not very prosh. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. That was the optimistic view. Settlement is not only possible, but probable. I think a very good way to start. Norman Watt.
Thank you all very much for coming, and thank you for inviting me. I always like to talk about Iran, a deeply fascinating subject. I'm sorry that Malcolm Rifkind isn't here, because he, I think, would have had slightly different views from the three of us. I think we're a little bit too similar, but I think I shall retreat to what Freud called the narcissism of small differences in order to try to make it more interesting. I think, comparing myself with Richard, am I optimistic or pessimistic? I would say I'm more pessimistic about a deal, but I am equally optimistic as him about the long-term prospect of a rapprochement and of Iran moving more into the Western camp in the long run. I very much agree with Richard that very few people in this country really understand how disliked the UK is. Disliked and fascinated by. But I was recounting to Douglas Hurd before lunch how astonished I was to read recently that when George Bush called Iran part of the axis of evil, some people stood up in the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, and said, no, no, that can't be right. It must be the British who said this, or it must be the British who caused the Americans to say this. Was the rollover a good outcome? Well, I think it was the second best outcome, but I think it was still a good outcome, and better than the alternative to have had a breakdown in acrimonious circumstances. The habit of dialogue, I think, will prove valuable, and it may lead to discussions on other matters. The issues in the negotiations were, as Richard said, the number of centrifuges, the duration of the agreement, verification, and the lifting of sanctions. When Jack Straw and I were in Tehran in January, we discussed with Foreign Minister Zarif this issue of the capacity of enrichment, and he described it as a great chasm then. And I have to say, I don't really see, of course I'd not party to what actually happened in the negotiations, how this gap can easily be bridged. According to what one reads in newspapers, the highest offer the West made for operating centrifuges was 4,500. The lowest figure that the Iranians would come down to was 8,000. And of course that leaves out of account 10,000 other installed but not operating centrifuges. And this struck me in January as a reason it was most unlikely there would be an agreement. And it strikes me today as still a very, very difficult issue to resolve. But as I say, I don't know what actually happened. And Secretary Kerry referred at the end of the talks to very good new proposals coming up towards the end. And President Rouhani said that Iranian scientists had come up with very good solutions. And I quote here, "We convinced the Americans that they were effective." Well, I wonder. That may have been for consumption domestically as well. The Iranians are very reluctant to demolish anything. They see they have invested a large amount of money, a large amount of time, and I think there is an issue of Islamic pride showing that a Muslim country is capable of being at the frontiers of scientific knowledge, and it's not often appreciated, but Ayatollah Khomeini laid a lot of emphasis on the compatibility and the desirability of science being part of the Islamic revolution and the Islamic Republic. Verification is a very important issue. The signs are, and I noticed the Deputy Speaker of the Majlis said this, that Iran would probably be open to signing the additional protocol so that you could have snap unannounced inspections of undeclared facilities. This is, of course, a key point, because in the past, Iran has developed facilities without declaring them, two of them, in fact, which has caused great concern. The Iranian defense of this has been that there was no nuclear material in the facilities at the time they were being constructed, and that they were under no legal obligation to declare them. But one way around that would be to get a firm agreement that the beginning, I think there is now under the NPT a subsidiary provision, whereby if you begin a new facility, you should be obliged to declare it when you begin it. The lifting of sanctions is obviously very important for the Iranian economy. I won't add to what Richard said that, except to say this one point. People often say it's sanctions that brought Iran to the negotiating table. Well, there's obviously some truth in that, but it's not the whole truth, because it was the fact that Rouhani, in the election, made his platform that he wanted to negotiate about the nuclear program. He wanted Iran to have better relations with the rest of the world. But the other candidates in the election did not necessarily subscribe to that. Mr. Jalili did not subscribe to that. And had Mr. Jalili become president, Iran would have continued very probably on the path on which it was already set and would not have been so interested in negotiations. Continuing with this rollover obviously leaves everything vulnerable to events. I would judge the US Congress to be a much bigger obstacle than the Majlis. According to some people's calculations, when the Republicans get their full quota in the US Senate, they will quickly be able to muster 66, which is very perilously close to the 67 senators required in order to constrain the president's powers. I think the last American president who was forced to impose sanctions against his will was actually Ronald Reagan against South Africa. But of course there are people in both houses of Congress talking about more sanctions now, and if that were to happen, that would be hugely problematic. If there is no agreement, that is going to have huge implications for the Rouhani presidency. He will perhaps be going the way of President Khatami. He will be left powerless and without with much less influence. I say that, but I think there is one important point about Rouhani's position that is very important to remember and bear in mind, and what makes Rouhani still a very significant figure, and that is that he has the backing of public opinion. He is popular. He did win the election by a very strong and very convincing margin, and that matters to the regime, and they do not, they're not going to ignore that easily. The fact that the talks are going to go on longer, of course, doesn't mean that they will necessarily succeed. A deal, I certainly think, is desirable. I think it's much better than the alternative. But I agree with Richard. If there is a deal, Iran is not going to become America's favoured ally overnight. But in the long run, I believe the geopolitical facts are altering. And at the moment, as someone put it, the Islamic Republic has a dysfunctional non-relationship with the United States. If the negotiations are successful, it might have a functional non-relationship with the United States. But if there is a deal and sanctions are dropped and Iran opens up to foreign investment and to more Western trade, this will be economically in the world a hugely important event. Iran is the last frontier market to open up, a big market. It would have a big impact on the world economy. And I can't believe that if Iran opens up and we saw a lot more foreign contact and a lot more foreign investment and interchange, that that wouldn't have profound implications both for Iranian society and for the Islamic Republic. And the reason that I'm optimistic in the long run is because I do believe that Iran is a country that has the capacity to evolve and to change itself. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael. And I too am doubly sorry that Malcolm Rifkin is not here. A, because I would have liked to listen to his views, which is different from the three of us, and B, because I would not have had to prepare in his place in some haste. Back in September 2005, there was one of the more extraordinary meetings of many extraordinary meetings that I attended as Foreign Secretary. This was hosted by Kofi Annan for protocol reasons, but was between Joschka Fischer, the German Foreign Minister, Michel Barnier, the French Foreign Minister, and myself. On one side of the table, with President Ahmadinejad and Ali Larijani, then the negotiator, on the other side of the table. The body language between the two of them was interesting. Ahmadinejad reminded me of a 1980s version of Ken Livingstone. Carefully contrived untidiness. Larijani was, of course, wearing the regulation no tie, but otherwise sporting a brand new polo, Ralph Lauren polo shirt. And looking every inch a middle-class Iranian. But the message from both of them was really tough and uncompromising. Just this week, the same Ali Larijani has said in a live interview on state television in Tehran, "I believe that Iran and the world power nuclear negotiations are making progress, and there is no reason to have a negative view about the talks." Pretty extraordinary statement, given Larijani's own position within Iranian politics, to make. So I'm not a natural optimist. Richard's a natural optimist here. I'm not certain what's going to happen, but I do think that there has been a... progress was made in November last year just to get that deal. And there is a possibility, maybe a good possibility, of a final deal next spring. And if not that, then certainly a rollover. The biggest block in the way of a deal is the attitude of the Israeli government and the influence which the Israeli government has on US politics. It's a single biggest problem. And one of my frustrations is that although the Israelis and Prime Minister Netanyahu plainly believe that their interests are served by defining themselves against Iran, presenting Iran as this terrible devil, and by having a weak and isolated Iran, I'm far from certain that their interests are served by placing Iran in that position. And those of you who would like some Christmas reading and are in the market for this, I recommend a book published a few years ago now by Trita Parsi called Treacherous Alliance. It's absolutely brilliant. And it describes the treacherous alliance between the United States, Israel, and Iran, and brings out in granular detail the way in which, post the revolution, and for more than 10 years, Israel and Iran went in for some unpleasant rebarbative rhetoric against each other in public, but carefully controlled that rhetoric, and underneath the smokescreen, essentially insulting each other, they cooperated. Israel was the only reliable supplier of arms to Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. Israel and Iran cooperated very well to transit quite a number of Iranian Jewish people to Israel. They wanted to leave. The Iranians decided not to stand in the way, and they cooperated on that and in many other respects. And when the policy shifted, it shifted not as a result of Likud's sudden antipathy towards Iran, but as a result of the Labour Party's sudden antipathy towards Iran under Rabin and Shimon Peres, when the Israelis and the Labour Party judged actually correctly that the Iranians were trying to undermine the Oslo Accord and the peace process. But I make this point to underline the fact that does not follow from Israel's own dealings with Iran post the Islamic Revolution that Iran has to be seen as some kind of devil. And my own view is, given everything else that's going on in the Middle East, they ought to revise their strategic analysis about not where their allies are, but whose interests would tend better to coincide with those of Israel. And I can't believe that it is in Israel's medium and long-term interest to have jihadists like ISIL controlling well over a third of Iraq and a good chunk of Syria, and proselytizing in a very powerful and effective way across the rest of the Middle East, because that is bound in the end to impact on Israel. Netanyahu, however, has placed a British shirt on some rhetoric which claims that Iran is about to weaponize its nuclear capacity. And it's going to be hard for them to climb down, as it is for their allies in Congress, who many of whom are funded by the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. It is worth bearing in mind, for those of you who wish to amuse yourself at Christmas, just go to Google and look at all the predictions which the Israelis have made like a drumbeat over the last 12 years that Iran was about to produce a nuclear weapon in the next 18 months. Surprise, surprise, it hasn't happened. In my judgment, it hasn't happened, because I don't think Iran wants to produce a nuclear weapon. I think they may want to produce the technical capacity should they ever feel terribly threatened. But I think, personally, I think they'd be crackers in their own terms to want to become a target of the nuclear arsenals, not just of the US and Israel, UK and France, but also of Russia, and maybe China aimed at them, and certainly Pakistan, and would lose hugely if they were to produce a weapon. The factors which are working in favour of a deal have been mentioned. The economy in Iran, exacerbated by this slide in the oil price. The oil price may well go up a bit, but it won't go up to where it was, as well as the fact that they're better off with Obama and John Kerry than they could be with the alternatives. The pressures on the West, of course, are similar to those I mentioned in respect of Israel. The fact that the geopolitics of the Middle East have changed so dramatically in the last year with the rise of jihadist ISIS. And there are also pressures, I think, within the E3+3 formation. Russia has, by all accounts, played its role within these negotiations with a straight bat, and indeed it's not in Russia's interest for Iran to be untethered. But Putin is now isolated. He's subject to very severe sanctions, which have been more severe on Russia than anybody they certainly anticipated. And quite easy to see that Russia's subscription to its sanctions, which are UN ones, breaking down. Germany and France have got strong commercial interests and potential interests in Iran. German business is hurting because of sanctions on Russia, and there will be those pressures there as well. And there's just increasing irritation in most countries in Europe about US foreign policy being dictated by Israel, given the fact that Israel has been so obdurate in not only stopping the peace process with the Palestinians, but also continuing to thieve Palestinian land. Just one last point about Britain. It is a tragedy that we have partially written ourselves out of the script. The embassy should be reopened. There is one block in the way where I think the British government is entirely right, and that is over ensuring that the Iranians allow access for a couple of containers containing equipment, which was completely trashed when the embassy was trashed. And the Iranians are raising technical problems to that, which are, and they're wrong to do so. But on the issue of the visas, which I know rather too much about, it is simply unacceptable for the Home Office to seek to impose conditions to reopening the embassy, which have not been imposed on other countries who are equally difficult over, say, returns of illegals and expired visa people. And I could mention a long list of those, including China, India, Pakistan and Nigeria. We don't close the embassies because we're irritated with them. We actually work at the diplomacy. Overall, all I can say as to whether there will be a deal or not is inshallah.